This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. There is plenty to talk about here in Toronto. It looks like the Great Resignation has hit City Council, and there's not exactly a stampede to snag one of those $120,000 jobs. With the deadline for registering just a week away, only a third as many candidates are throwing their hats in the ring compared to 2018. And as a few days ago, the number of candidates, 84 versus 242 in the last election. And we'll check in on the brewing war between cyclists and pedestrians in Hyde Park, with the cyclists crying police harassment. And it's not just cyclists that threaten pedestrians. Three pedestrians were hit by cars on one morning, yesterday morning alone. What does that say for all those Vision Zero claims? And the strong mayor legislation has been tabled as expected. What do you think? 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740.
And now it's time to tune into the town.
And now I'd like to welcome Lauren O'Neill, senior news editor of Blog TO, Councillor James Pasternak, Ward 6, York Centre, and Councillor Brad Bradford, Ward 19, Beaches, East York. Hello, everyone.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
We're doing good.
So let's start with the city councillors we're talking to. So what do you make of the large volume of resignations and the fact that there aren't that many candidates, Brad?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I think if you look at Toronto City Council over the past 4 to 5 years, we really have seen more change than in the decades that preceded it. And, you know, that goes back from the reduction of seats from 44 to 25. Now we have the new strong mayor legislation. And I think it just reflects sort of the changing dynamic in a big city. The job is not an easy one. It's very demanding. I think folks are focused on how they create impact. And politics is certainly one way to do that. But there's lots of other opportunities and avenues to create an impact and make a difference in our city. And folks are exploring that. Obviously, our democracy is strongest when it's a competition of ideas. So we want folks to step up and get their name on the ballot, and they still have a week to do that. There's lots of campaigning left to do. But it is interesting that we're seeing folks step away. I think it's different in every context, and if you listen to the councillors and who are leaving, their reasons are quite varied, from, you know, more time with their family to some of the mental health impacts. And I think it's different for every person. But I am hopeful that more people get their names on the ballot and register in the week ahead. And again, it's all about a competition of ideas at City Hall.
Okay, before I move on to James, Brad, do you think it's a good job? Do you enjoy your job?
I don't think everybody enjoys every minute and every moment of every job.
Of any job, yeah?
Yeah, of any job. But I will say it's been incredibly rewarding for me. Beaches East York in particular is a very engaged constituency. And whether I'm getting lit up on Facebook, or we're having a community meeting, or we're getting together in a park to discuss our hopes and aspirations for what we'd like to see there, whether we're doing housing or bike lanes, all this sort of stuff, change generates conversation. It generates a wide range of views and opinions. But it really is about the future of our community and the future of the city. I'm just very blessed to be in a position where I can help support and lead that change. And it's very rewarding. Like I said, there's a lot of ways to make an impact, but certainly local government is among one of the best opportunities.
James Pasternak, do you still like your job?
Yeah, it's truly an honor to serve the neighborhoods and community of York Centre Downsview. My team is a very positive team that helps people every day. It's a lifelong dream to serve as an elected official. It was very tough this past term because of The shrinkage of council by 19 seats and the doubling of the wards. Councillors now have over 100,000 people to service. I think it's unsustainable. I think a few councillors are leaving because it's just become a meat grinder. You've got a couple of councillors there who are veterans who have been there 30 years or just slightly less, and it's their time to sort of move on. And then you've got another group, as Brad mentioned, of young families. I mean, they have kids well under 10, and they're missing out by being out so many nights a week and weekends. They're missing out on the raising of their families, and they've decided to leave council and focus more on family. So it's a tough job, but it's an extremely rewarding job, and it's been an honor to serve.
Lauren, so there's this push-pull. So it is a harder job than when there were many more wards. But on the one hand, you have that it's a tough job. There are people who are saying, gee, you know, this is concerning because it's people leaving with a lot of experience. And I'm pretty sure it takes quite a while before you even figure out where the washrooms are. But on the other hand, it's an opportunity for renewal. So how do you see it?
You know, I see this as part of almost the larger great resignation we've been seeing post-pandemic in the society. It's been a challenging term for councillors, for sure. Not just with all of the change and gaining more constituents by default, the shrinking of the number of seats, but also like we're in a state of emergency, rolling lockdowns. Like these are all really stressful things. And so generally, you know, the unemployment rate has gone like down or not as many people are working as before. And you see a lot of people maybe reevaluate their priorities and want to spend more time with their family, realize life is short. I mean, that would be part of it. And the other part might just be that, you know, it's gotten too challenging. It's too stressful with that many people. And maybe they could consider having more seats on council again. I don't know if that would be the solution. I know councillors Bradford and Pasternak know the ins and outs of this a lot better than I do. But it's concerning to see. And I do have a question for all of you. Like, what does one need to do to apply? What qualifies a person to be a city councillor? Can anyone just apply?
Well, sure. Entry is actually easier at the municipal level than at the other levels of government, where there's party machinery that forces you to either win a nomination or be appointed by the party leader. For city council, it's usually residency in Toronto or $100, no criminal record, and you're good to go.
Bar is low.
Yeah. I mean, anyone listening out there who has an interest in politics.
Yeah, so, I mean, we really encourage people to put their names forward for public service in this way. We want a very vibrant democracy with a lot of sharing of ideas. So when it comes to entry into elected office, the municipal level, and of course, there's other positions as well. There's the school boards. There's four school boards in Toronto. Which are also looking for candidates, and entry there is the same. And if someone is thinking of public office, that is the easiest route to do.
Let me ask you this. Okay, so the bar is low for entry, but how much money do you need? And is it an impediment that if you campaign and you lose, so you're still on the hook for the cash personally, aren't you?
Who would like to answer that one? I'll just jump in very quickly. First of all, you do have to have the ability to raise money. And there are restrictions and rules governing using your own money. So you're not on the hook. You're not really technically allowed to carry a deficit campaign. But deficits can be wiped out in the post-election period. But it's very difficult to do unless you win. So raising money is tricky. We have something called the rebate program, where if someone gives a donation, you do get
you tax get receipt.
50 to 75% of it back. It's not tax credit. But at the provincial and federal levels, the Income Tax Act is very favorable to political donations, and you have a party machinery that's constantly trying to raise money. So raising money as an individual is a challenge. And unless you raise that money, you're going to have a tough time winning.
Yeah.
Libby, I would just add to that. You know, when I ran in 2018, that was my first time running for office. And, you know, I was a policy guy. I worked in the chief planner's office at the City of Toronto. So very new and perhaps naive to politics, wasn't aware of many of the things I've learned over the past 4 years. But I would encourage folks who are thinking about it, and you still got time, a week or so to get on the ballot. You know, the fundraising hurdles are there. But I would say even more important than fundraising, we ran a very grassroots campaign that was very volunteer oriented, and folks that just had a set of shared values and aspirations for our community and for Toronto. And, you know, the pathway to victory, you know, in our case was going to 50,000 doors over the course of the 5 month campaign and grinding it out and having those conversations on the doorstep, in the apartment hallways, you know, in the public parks, and talking to people about what matters to them and listening and taking that feedback. And so while dollars are really important, because you got to be able to, you know, print the literature to leave at the door, and it certainly helps make a campaign run smoother. Most of our donations kind of came in on the back half of the campaign because it was a crowded and contested race. And, you know, it wasn't until the later weeks of the campaign where that stuff started to go. But you can make a lot of inroads and connect with a lot of people just by going to the doors and building up volunteers and having folks get out there and listen to folks in the community. So volunteers and putting in the time and the effort and pounding the pavement, that's a really, really big part of it in a grassroots campaign. And then the money will come.
Well, you know what? I mean, you have to have people who are willing to take the time to work for you. And there's this other thing where it's almost impossible to defeat an incumbent. And, you know, people are not that engaged in municipal politics. The voter turnout is low. So it's difficult, and it's difficult even if you have name recognition. You know who we should have been talking to about this is our own Liz West. She ran for council once.
Oh, no way.
That's right.
And she did not win, even though she had, from we were colleagues at City TV, she had quite the name recognition, but it didn't work out. And I remember one of our very good camera people was her campaign manager, was quite a while ago. But it's not an easy thing. So what about this, you know, this kind of, intransigency, immovability of the incumbents? I mean, now that you're elected, James, does that mean like it's almost impossible to unseat you?
Well, no, nothing's impossible. I go back to 2010 when I was one of 14 councillors who came onto council, newbies, they called us, fresh faces. And of those 14, only three are going to be on the ballot this time around. So 12 years later, 11 have moved on to other things. I believe one of them is the premier. So incumbents do lose. Back to 2010, six incumbents lost. That election cycle, it is hard to defeat an incumbent, you know, because someone has a track record and they developed relationships within the ward boundaries. But incumbents have fallen, and with a well funded grassroots campaign, as Brad mentions, incumbents could have a big race on their hands.
Lauren, you're into politics. You are in a community of people who are into municipal politics. Are any of them thinking of running? Is this something that you think is a good idea for any of you? Or is it, do you shake your heads and say, no, never, not me?
I think at this time, it's a little late in the game.
For this election.
But yeah, no, I don't really see anyone who's jumping to get into municipal politics right now. And I think just seeing so many councillors who are giving their seats up, it kind of spooks people in that way as well. It's like, ooh, well, maybe this isn't such a great job if we have this huge resignation of people who don't want to do it anymore. But perhaps next time around, you know, there will be some, you know, snappy young candidates who try their hand at it. But yeah, I mean, this time around, like Councillor Bradford was saying, it's like a 5 month campaign. There's only a short amount of time left. So for anyone to come in, and especially to unseat an incumbent in any ward, would be really, really tough at this point. I mean, I think a lot of people my age don't even know the difference between who we're voting for on the municipal and federal and provincial level, like when it comes to MPPs and MPs and councillors. We just see so many names and so many flyers. Like, I've talked to people and I'm like, well, who's your city councillor? They're like, I don't know. I think it's like, and they'll name like an MP. I'm like, that's not your city councillor. There's just so much information coming all the time at people.
Well, and speaking of the demographics of this, I'm just going to give my weekend show, Zoomer Weekend Review, a plug. So I was talking to David Crombie about this, and he thinks that maybe running for council could be a good, or being on council, a good second career for Zoomers. So I'll have more on that on the weekend, on Sunday at noon. And now let's move on to another hot topic, and that is like the war between cyclists and pedestrians and cops. That is among the three of them. So the cyclists that, and we've seen pictures of them moving in a phalanx really quickly, and they're saying they're being harassed by cops. Now, I just want to bring my husband's point of view. He is a monster cyclist, and he will go in the afternoon 60, 80 kilometers, sometimes even more. He's not a young person. He's unbelievably fit. And his take on it, he said he's been at the, you know, the south end of High Park there. He said you can easily end up going 40 or 50 kilometers an hour. And if any pedestrian gets in your way, you're going to take them down. So he thinks these cyclists are just being overly aggressive and entitled. So what do you think of that explanation, Brad Bradford?
Well, you know, I ride a lot of bikes too, and folks might be aware of that. And, you know, it's a complicated issue. I think a lot of us generally think about the propensity for harm. And I'm not saying that a collision with a cyclist or a pedestrian, is not a problem. Of course it is. But when we have such limited enforcement, tools available and, you know, you look at the injuries and pedestrians hit by vehicles, and the drivers of those vehicles just this week, there is a real, challenge here on the streets in Toronto and all big cities and conflicts of uses. So the enforcement side is one piece, but I think fundamentally, all of this speaks to how we design our spaces, our public parks, and our roads, and how we design them from a perspective to how do we make them safe for all users. So High Park is a popular cycling destination. Your husband's probably ridden there, and I've ridden there myself. And you ride around, and you see a lot of folks on bikes, you see a lot of people in cars, and you see a lot of pedestrians. So we need to come up with a design solution and perhaps a programming solution that helps better mitigate those challenges and conflicts between modes. And I will say, you know, I don't know every park in the city of Toronto. I think we have probably 1,500 or so. But High Park is one of the only parks where you can actually drive into the center of the park. A lot of places direct the parking towards the periphery.
They limit that. I mean, there are lots.
They do limit that. We have been piloting some programs where there are car-free moments and days in High Park. But it is a unique layout. And I think that kind of goes back to the design piece. Do you want roads for cars driving into the middle of this big, spectacular park in High Park? Or do we want to make sure that folks have access to the parking, but also recognize a lot of people are getting there on transit because it's on a subway or they're walking? And how can we program that space better for pedestrians, cyclists, and folks who are driving to the park as well?
Yeah, but okay. I've looked at the pictures, and a lot of cyclists are wonderful, including my husband and Brad Bradford, but some are extremely aggressive. Sometimes they ride kind of in a phalanx across where nobody else can use the roadway. There are a lot of cyclists who are extremely aggressive, you know, even against a car. They're kind of daring you. And, you know, it looks to me that situation in High Park, they are just being extremely aggressive. Lauren.
It has come to a head. I mean, this has been a problem for a while, according to local residents. I just learned this term through Ben Spur at the Toronto Star, mammals. middle-aged men in Lycra. Middle-aged men in Lycra who speed down, treating the road like it's their own personal Tour de France. And I think that is the problem. There are lots of respectful cyclists, like you said, at High Park and elsewhere. But it's when these, you know, select few, and they're not just at High Park. I've encountered them on like the Don Valley Trail.
Okay, they're not just middle-aged. Some of them are young.
Some of them are young.
And some of them are old.
Yeah. All men in Lycra with the pointy helmet.
It's true. You know, I haven't really seen aggressive women cyclists, even though a lot of great women cyclists.
That's true. I mean, when I'm cycling, the most aggressive I'll get is like, hey, when a car kind of comes too close. But I think the problem is that there's like Councillor Bradford was saying, there's just so many uses of the road, so many people using the road in different ways. And we need to look at kind of how we change the infrastructure to support that. Because when High Park was built, I don't think it was built with cars, pedestrians, rollerbladers, e-bikes, scooters, all of these things in mind.
But in the meantime, is there a problem with ticketing these guys, these, what are they called? Mammals?
Mammals.
Mammals. Yeah. These mammals who are being really aggressive. James Pasternak, is there a problem with that?
Well, I mean, I think it's important to remember and point out that cyclists are must abide by all our bylaws and provisions of the Highway Traffic Act. They're bound by those, and they've got to follow all the rules of the road. The other thing is to remember that, you know, we have an aging population, and we've got to be very respectful of pedestrians and residents who use our sidewalks and also have to share the road. I think there is a propensity to, for some cyclists, I cycle, to sort of take this view of stop me if you can, and that they are going to carve out the middle of the road rather than curb lanes.
Yeah.
So, at the same time, I worry that this is not a priority, that police resources are spread so thin. And that, you know, we need our 911 calls answered up in York Center Downsview on a timely basis.
Yeah, but I don't think the guys ticketing cyclists in the park are the same ones answering your 911 calls. That's, you know, I don't think so.
Resources are resources, and budgetary issues, I'm told repeatedly that they can't answer various calls on a timely basis because of budgeting and resources. So
I would just add to James's point. He makes a good one there. That's Division 11, I believe, and it's not in either of our jurisdictions, but I'm sure that their inboxes and phone lines also get flooded with a lot of complaints and concerns about speeding traffic through side streets or speeding traffic in school zones. And so again, when we think about the propensity for harm and, you know, the 2,000 pound vehicle that's speeding through a school zone doing 60, and our kids are out there or seniors zone. Again, these vulnerable users, that to my mind is where we really, in a world of limited and constrained resources, that is where we need to be directing those resources. And you know, I think we're going to talk about it, but the risk to pedestrians out here in the city of Toronto, we're doing a lot of work on it, but obviously we have a lot more work to do. And enforcement is a big part of it. So, you know, cyclists get a bad rep and sometimes it's certainly deserved. And when there's a clip on CP24 of a cyclist going past a pedestrian and telling them to go fly a kite, that doesn't help. And I actually take that message to the cycling community and I say, look, this is not helpful. This is not good behavior. And when we talk about take the lane, share the road, you know, we are required to follow the rules of the road. If we want to be treated as a vehicle on the road, then, you know, it's on all of us to try our best to follow that. But I do think the conversation of whataboutism is never really helpful because, you know, we literally issue tens of thousands of tickets in our automatic speed enforcement, tens of thousands of tickets, for red light running infractions. That stuff happens on our streets. You know, it's not just made up. We have the cameras and the tickets to prove it. And, you know, pedestrians jaywalk. And so, like, there's a lot of folks who don't follow the letter of the law and our rules on the road. And I think that's why, ultimately, the best solution is design and programmatic changes so that we can address that in a way that we get the kind of behavior on our roads that we want to see because they're built that way.
Yeah, okay. Though I bet that that police division got a lot of complaints about High Park, and maybe that's why that happened. But before we wrap things up, I'm going to take a call here from Sam in Toronto. Hi, Sam.
Hello. How are you, Libby?
Fine. How are you?
Thank you very much. I just want to make a small point. I think this gentleman made a good point, but based in resources, you know, when there is like mayhem of construction, it's like a war zone in Toronto, which is getting worse and worse. I don't see cops and police department are stopping not once all these dump trucks, like thousands of dump trucks in Toronto that create a lot of security issues and accidents. And, you know, they're rushing to the sites, you know, maybe there's a conflict of interest because they get paid by construction companies to watch the sites. I don't know, but they're wasting their resources on cyclists. How many cyclists have killed people? How many dump trucks have killed people?
That's a good point.
Well, that's a good line. Thanks for that, Sam.
Thank you.
Okay. Let us, before we wrap things up, move along to Strong Mayor. We've heard a lot of different things from different people. John Tory says he won't govern any differently. The mayor of Ottawa doesn't think it's a good idea. So, James, how do you think of your job in terms of this? Do you have less say? Are you less happy because of this or more?
Well, I would say that the whole thing's a bit puzzling. A mayor of this city, particularly this mayor, wins just about every single vote they have a passion for. They want a policy passed. So they have those kinds of powers in place now to carry counsel on important public policy issues to the mayor. If this is an effort to accelerate the building of housing, I don't really see how that's possible, because much of the delays of housing have nothing to do with the mayor or council. They're kind of structural processes, appeal, judicial issues, engineering issues that slow down construction. The mayor's added power would not accelerate the building of houses. The last point I would make before I let others chime in is I think this will create a more acrimonious council setting where the mayor may use the veto. Council may mobilize to try and overrun it. There will be tension between the council floor and the mayor. I think this mayor is very responsible with these powers, but we don't know what the future will bring.
Brad, what do you think about your job and your power, if we put it that way, in the light of this?
Well, it's interesting, like the conversations of power. I never really think about that. I think about the pathways and the abilities to get things done. And you don't have to follow municipal government very closely to know that there's probably room for improvement in us delivering on the folks, on the things that folks expect us to do. So I'm very open-minded, and I have been and will continue to be, on any proposals that come forward to help improve local government service delivery for residents. You know,
what was that, Brad? I think we just lost Brad.
No. Oh, dear.
Oh, okay. Lauren?
I mean, speaking of power, I think a lot of people are seeing this move toward the strong mayor system as simply Doug Ford trying to get more power over the city of Toronto again, because the mayor will have the power to veto any council vote if it conflicts with provincial priorities, which have not been defined yet. So I will have more of, I guess, an opinion on it when I see what these provincial priorities are. But right now, a lot of people are saying, well, I mean, how do you become the mayor of Toronto without getting elected as the mayor of Toronto? You know, just.
Yeah, but then on the other hand, we've got to remember the mayor of Toronto is elected with more votes than anyone in the country, including the prime minister or the premier.
Yeah, which is why it makes it kind of concerning to some people, I think, that will Ford just be able to kind of puppet the new mayor through this system? Like, well, that conflicts
imagine.
With the provincial priority. I mean, we'll see.
Okay, is Brad there to say goodbye to him? I guess not. Brad, thanks very much for that. James, last 20 seconds to you. What are you watching for in the last day when people can register?
Well, look, I'm excited about this election campaign. It's a great opportunity to go to tens of thousands of doors and hear residents one-on-one. Obviously, a robust democracy requires people to put their names forward and run. And while the first election outing for some may be frustrating, many people try a couple of times. So I'm looking forward to getting out there, knocking on the doors, and getting to hear what Torontonians have to say so we can make the next
term of council extremely successful.
I almost forgot to ask you, is anyone running against you?
Yes, no, I do have a couple of people running against me. I take all competition very seriously. So we're out there already knocking on doors and speaking to people. And our big challenge is we're really running against apathy because the provincial turnout was very low. So we've got to get people involved, engaged, and we've got to get them to the polls.
Okay, well, I am sure we will talk about this many times. Thank you so much, Brad Bradford, who we've lost, James Pasternak, and Lauren O'Neill. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Libby.
Okay, you're very welcome, Libby. Take care. All the best.
Okay, all the best to you. We're taking a break. And when we come back, a historic election at Uniform, which is Canada's largest private sector union. We'll talk about that.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Now we turn to an historic election at Canada's largest private sector union. Unifor has elected Lara Payne as its first woman national president. It comes as the organization is trying to recover from the Jerry Dias scandal. He resigned before it was revealed that he took a $50,000 kickback from a COVID test manufacturer for pushing their product. Well, yeah. So now I am joined by Dr. Rafael Gomez, an associate professor of employment relations at the University of Toronto. Hello, Dr. Gomez. Thanks for joining us.
No, it's my pleasure.
How significant is this?
The election. Well, it represents, I think, a shift that's been happening in the union movement for the past 20, maybe 30 years. You know, I think maybe we still have a stereotype of the union member. Just conjure that up in your head. You think what? Blue collar, manufacturing, male, white. That's all changed. The typical union member now is more likely to be female than male by several percentage points, like a 5 percentage point difference. Like overall in Canada, we have about 30% of the workforce unionized. Of course, that splits in many different ways. But again, the one way it does split is, you know, women are now more likely to be union members than men.
Right. But I would guess, and please correct mm-hmm. me if I'm wrong, that the women would be very heavily represented in the healthcare unions sure. and in the civil service unions, which is not Unifor.
Well, no, Unifor has entered that space because yeah. they're so big. Remember, Unifor is an amalgam, right?
Yeah.
A conglomerate, if you will, of the union movement. It's actually absorbed lots of workers that now have essentially become part of the what's called the broader public sector, you know, that sector that's yeah. basically funded, regulated by government. Think about a lot of, you know, services, social services that are kind of done by third parties. Those have increasingly become unionized, and that's where Unifor has seen its biggest growth. By far, you know, the auto workers are still a huge piece of the Unifor puzzle and also the culture that spawned Unifor. But don't forget, the growth is not there. It's in services and what we might call the broader public sector. Broader public sector in Canada now has 77% of the workforce unionized versus, this is crazy, 14% in the private sector.
Yep, yep. I don't know what that says about the future of the union movement, but...
It puts it into question because that's almost a huge imbalance. Because if you think about it, the needs and interests of all workers share a lot of commonalities, right? Decency, good pay, fairness, all of that. However, it's differently when you think about major projects that might create jobs in the private sector, but kind of stand against the norms or values of, say, a typical public sector worker. Think about energy projects that could generate huge numbers of good-paying private sector jobs, but which might be opposed by the kind of value system that are present in those public sector workforces, right? So yeah, it does create a division. It creates a bifurcation, an inequality, if you will, because if you have good protection, good paying jobs in one sector, and it's there because of unionization, but it's all dominated by public sector, then you think about the resentment that could build up in private sector workers who don't see the same protections coming to them.
Well, I think the resentment is already there, quite frankly. Final question to you, and that is, could part of the election of a woman, the first ever woman, be that, they're coming out of a crisis, basically? Maybe it's a bit of a poison chalice?
Oh, that's interesting, right? Kind of the way in which political parties have historically done that in Canada, right? To our female leaders, put them in place, Kim Campbell and others. I don't think so. You got to remember, Unifor is a big, powerful organization in Canada. The election is like any election, as opposed to an appointment. This was a membership-based and driven decision, right? It's all votes count. And I think this reflects, as I said, the changing composition of the typical union member, the way the union movement has evolved over the last 20 years, and perhaps Unifor signaling that's the space in which they will continue to advocate for.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Rafael Gomez.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And before we go to break, this just in. And those of you who've been listening, we lost Brad Bradford in our conversation shortly before the end. Well, Lauren O'Neill said he just direct messaged him. The power went out at City Hall. That was the reason. Wow. We've been having trouble with all kinds of basic services. So the power went out at City Hall. And Brad, thanks for letting us know. Right now, we're taking a break. And when we come back, the specter of privatization of our healthcare. One day, the health minister says yes. Today, she says no. We will talk all about that. And we'd like to hear from you. 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740 when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Are you worried about privatization of our health care? Well, yesterday, Health Minister Sylvia Jones said that further privatization was one of the options for solving the crisis that she won't acknowledge as a crisis. Well, today she clarified that whatever happens, our single government payer system will remain in place. Are you reassured? Where does that leave us? The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And now let's go to Charlene Stewart, president of SEIU Healthcare, which represents 60,000 healthcare workers in the province, and Franche Elina, NDP MPP for Nickel Belt and the Health Critic. Women, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Libby. Hi, France.
She clarified just a couple of hours ago at Queen's Park, single payer system stays. Are you reassured, Charlene?
No, quite frankly, I'm not. That announcement yesterday, as I said, it was like unfathomable that Premier Ford would kick open the doors to further privatization of our healthcare system after what we experienced in the last 2 years. What Ontario was exposed to, we saw the grave failures that the for-profit nursing homes under that model, the results that came out of that and are still having bad results, the care in there, the shortage of staff. So it really did surprise me yesterday. And today what she's saying is exactly replicating the model that we see in long-term care and home care.
Let me ask you this, France. We have a lot of privatized medicine, which is it's a private supplier. All family doctors are private small businesses, and there are all kinds of clinic services. I mean, everything from imaging and testing that are also done by private companies.
You are absolutely right, Libby. Ontario is the province where the delivery of publicly funded healthcare has been the most privatized. We have hundreds of millions of dollars that benefit wealthy shareholders at the expense of sick people. You will remember when Mike Harris was there, privatized home care, privatized long-term care. Home care was going to do things better, faster, cheaper if it was going to be privatized in 2022. Do you think that our home care system is better, faster, cheaper because we have privatized? Absolutely not.
Well, I'm not. I've written about this before. Not thrilled with the government system either. To be quite frank, I'm not sure. Actually, you know, when it comes to home care, you can't compare the prices. But actually, when I've dealt with private home care companies, they've been pretty good. but I digress.
No, you're absolutely right. If you have the money to pay.
No, it was paid by the government, some of it, and delivered by a private company.
The idea is really, like Charlene just said, we just came out of a pandemic. Would you say that the people living in a long-term care home managed by the private sector were doing better or worse than the people?
We all know the answer to that.
Yeah, they all know. The great majority of people who died horrible deaths of starvation, covers in feces, and not being washed. None of that happened in the not-for-profit. It happened in the for-profit homes. And this is what they are looking at. I just attended the scrum with the minister again, and it is clear they have been working on this for some time. They already have big investors who are willing to make the investment to build the new surgical suite that would allow a whole bunch of surgeries to be done faster and make hundreds of millions of dollars for friends of the conservatives who will invest in those clinics and make hundreds of millions of dollars off of the back of sick people and people needing surgery.
I mean, they already do things like colonoscopies, mammograms, all those things, and it does take pressure off hospitals. Do you think that care is substandard?
Not necessarily the care, but research after research will show you that they are called independent health facilities. All of the independent health facilities in Ontario are private for-profit, except for one, and all of the independent health facilities always have a fee. So if you go for your colonoscopy to screen for cancer screening, yay, I encourage you to do this. You go in the hospital, it's absolutely free. You go in a private clinic, and then they'll say, I think you should talk to the nutritionist before coming. She sits right here. She's at $170 an hour. I think you should use this lens rather than that lens for your cataract surgery. And that lens happens to be $400.
Oh, the upselling, yeah.
The same ophthalmologist, the same patient, the same surgery in a hospital is free. You put it in a private clinic, there is always a fee, and you have this power imbalance. How do you tell a specialist who's about to gain you your sight back that you don't want to spend $400? You don't have $400 for that fancy lens he wants to put in. It's really difficult to do. So it's a barriers to care to a lot of people who don't have $400, and sometimes they're $600 and $800.
Now, I want to get to this business about the nursing agencies. And again, you know, I've said on the, I don't understand why the government doesn't, you know, repeal 124, because there's no way that a 1% increase is going to be what they can get away with. But that aside, so they're paying a lot of money for agencies, but even if Bill 124 was repealed tomorrow, that would not ease the shortage of nurses in the short term. Am I wrong about that, Charlene?
You know, and Libby, listening to you and Franz go back and forth, I mean, it's about priorities and investing in our own people, in our own province, putting the money right directly into care and wages, to your point. Agencies is another good example. You know, the workers aren't really getting a whole lot more money in the agencies. Once the agencies take their profits off, they're barely making the same or much more than what they make working at the hospital. So what the premier and the health minister has to do is prioritize and make this top of mind, investing in their own people. The Premier Ford says that all the time. Let's invest in Ontario. Well, let's do that. Let's invest in our own people. This privatization, kicking it, like you said, just cracking open the door a little bit, you know, the privatization, colonoscopies, cataracts, that's just the beginning. People are going to have to start to pay for dignified care. Look at it in long-term care already. If you want to have an extra bath a week, if you want to have more than what you don't have to hide the briefs that your family will get briefs, you have to pay for that. We have to pay for dignified care, and I don't think that's what we want in Canada. Take the States, for example. Pretty soon you start to pay a little bit, you end up paying more, and you're getting less for it.
Okay, but
very cautious about
to the nursing question, what I'm asking is, if it was repealed tomorrow, they would probably still have to use agencies to at least some degree. Am I wrong?
It would turn the page, Libby.
I agree with that totally.
You have hundreds and thousands of nurses leaving the profession every month. From May to June, we lost 5,400 healthcare workers, and every month is getting worse. They are discouraged. They just, you know, like, healthcare takes place between two human beings, between a healthcare professional and a patient. Both of them need to be respected in order to have quality care. Right now, the nurses come on the front of Queen's Park, write emails and tells them, we feel disrespected. The pandemic was hard. There were directives that cover nurses and hospital workers that says, we can reschedule you anywhere we want, anytime we want. They would come in for their shift and say, no, you're going to a long-term care home today. Come in for their shift in dialysis and be told, no, you're going to screen for COVID-19 today. That was really hard. Plus, dealing with the pandemic was hard. And then they have this Bill 124 on top of it. They feel disrespected. Remember, good quality care, you respect the caregiver, you respect the patient, you get quality care.
No, I agree with you on all of that. But what I'm saying is, and I agree that it's a lot of money to spend on agencies, but that even if it was repealed tomorrow, that's not going to solve it overnight, right?
No, but Libby, it'll make an absolute immediate difference. Right now, the healthcare workers are hearing, yes, I'm not worth it. They capped my wages at 1%. Now they're going to pull more money out of the public purse to pay private people to do the work, private agencies. Why not show them the respect and dignity that they're desperately seeking? That's why they're walking out the doors. Why wouldn't the premier stand up today and say, I'm repealing Bill 124? Give these people a lifeline, some hope that maybe the premier and the minister of health really sees them. But day after day, repeal or place Bill 124. Let's cap them. Let's not address the staffing shortages. Let's not look at incentives to bring back retired nurses. If they reversed all of that and showed that they are at least starting to have an immediate plan, I guarantee you, because the frontline workers are telling me that, if they saw any signs of respect and a plan to deal with them, they would be back. Yes, like, it's not going to happen overnight, but I guarantee you, today is just another slap in the face for those workers that, let's privatize your work instead of deal with your work and make it dignified, quality care and pay you wages and full-time jobs and benefits.
Okay, let's take a call from Ron in Guelph. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Libby. Thanks for taking my call at the last minute. So we already have some privatized stuff because Life Labs in our area is privatized.
Yep, labs, lots of labs.
And it works very well. I had surgery recently for hernia, and some people asked me, well, didn't you go to the shoulder ice? And I said, well, the surgery of the shoulder ice is covered on OHIP, but you have to stay in the clinic for 3 days. And it probably would have been a better choice because I had complications after my hernia surgery, and I ended up back in emergency 3 nights in a row.
Sorry to hear that.
That was every night.
Sorry to hear that you went through that. You're okay now?
Well, yeah, it's just, and I'm not blaming the nurse. It's a tough job, but I ended up with some complications. I had to put a catheter in. The nurse didn't install it properly. I ended up with more pain and infections and whatnot. So these would have all been dealt with had I stayed at the shoulder ice. But again, it costs more to go to the shoulder ice, a private clinic. But I'm not against some privatization if they can make it efficiently and still people can still get paid by OHIP. I don't see a problem.
Okay, thanks for your call. Anybody have a response to Ron in Guelph?
Absolutely. This is by design, Libby, that Ron is not convinced that our publicly deliver is not able to provide quality care. We had 5 years of zero base budget increase for a hospital. Since then, they've always been below cost of living increases. If you starve the public system that it cannot provide we have some expectation as to what quality care looks like, then any alternative looks good. And privatizing, oh, it looks good. Look, there's quality here. There's quality if you have money. But something that defines us as Canadian is that Medicare care is based on needs, not on ability to pay. It doesn't matter if you're rich or poor. It doesn't matter if you're tall or short or old or young. You get care based on needs, not on ability to pay. This is something that every Canadian is proud of. But if you let our public system run down enough, then people will say, hey, I'll pay for quality care when they have the money to pay. And for the rich, it will be a beautiful thing. For the rest of Ontarians, the studies after studies are there. You can read the BC Supreme Court on Dr. Day, who wanted to have a private clinic, and the rest of the people pay with longer wait time. The staff goes from the public sector to the private sector, and it's just the private sector becomes with really poor quality care. And if you can afford to pay, you will get great care. Not everybody can. The number one reason of personal bankruptcy in the U.S. is sickness.
We understand that. And I think we also have a Canada Health Act. And if there's two-tier care, the province won't get money from the federal government. We only have a minute left. Charlene, France alluded to agreements in place about private surgical centers. What can you tell us about that in less than a minute, please?
Well, in less than a minute, I think the announcement today and yesterday really did take some people back. It wasn't mentioned during the election platform. So what I'd like to see, and I'm sure the people of Ontario, is what is it? Transparency. I think maybe some of this is an indication why he won't deal with the crisis right before him and repeal Bill 124. So he's got to be transparent. What are your plans?
Okay, I think that is a good note to wrap things up on. Doug Ford, Sylvia Jones, what are your plans? Thank you so much, Franche Gélina and Charlene Stewart.
Pleasure talking to you, Libby, and nice to talk to you, Charlene.
Okay. You too, take care.
Take care, all of you. That's all the time we have for today. Free for All Friday is coming up tomorrow. And yeah, I'd like to hear your stories. What do you think about this? Are you worried that this is the kind of thin edge of the wedge? On the other hand, not keeping up with inflation, but the actual size of the healthcare budget, it's record. It's not like it's less than it was before, but it's not keeping up with inflation. Lots to talk about tomorrow, and that is all the time we have for today.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.